So let's cultivate our motivation. Again, having a sense of gladness for having the opportunity to listen to the Dharma. And even though it may not be the best of circumstances, maybe you don't feel so well, or maybe your legs hurt, or you have the hiccups, still, you feel incredibly fortunate to have the opportunity and willing to put up with the difficulties, knowing that you're using your life in a worthwhile way. Developing your good qualities, learning something you didn't know before, so let's keep that in mind as we generate a compassionate mind seeking full awakening. So I was thinking there's some big insect that was kept hitting me. And I was thinking, you know, it's a valid direct perceiver regarding the sound of the insect. And I could tell it was kind of a big insect because of the way it felt on the skin. So it was a direct reliable cognizer regarding that, but exactly what insect it was, I don't know. So it wasn't a direct cognizer regarding the specific insect. Yeah. So you can have yeah, this can be an interesting teaching. I have the hiccups and a stomach ache together. So yeah, come on. Good. Okay. Let's go on. So, you know, you can have one perception that is correct regarding one thing but incorrect regarding the other. I heard some noise. I could tell there was noise on the steps. I couldn't tell. It was valid regarding that. But I couldn't tell whether it was the cats or a human being. So it wasn't reliable in terms of what noise was on the stairway. But it does remind me to remind people to please come on time. Okay? So it's the same thing. You can be reliable in one aspect and not in another. Okay, now after last week, Venerable Dhamcha wrote something, so I thought I'd go through it. She found some notes that I had given her to type up that answered some of the questions. And by the way, I found in some notes I was looking at today, I did find a reference to the something being an empowering condition, but that not the unique empowering condition. So we had that argument, and I had said I had never heard of that before. Well, actually I had, but I couldn't remember. So what kind of cognizer is that? Hmm? You learned something and then you forgot it and you said the opposite. It's the wrong consciousness. Okay. So, anyway, that ends that debate, except it only ends it by relying on a reliable, an authoritative testimony, and whether that means that any of us really think it's important or believe it is another question, but we won't talk about that. I mean, does it change your path to enlightenment to know that? Okay, so here's what she wrote. I was thinking about how I grew up in an apartment complex where there was a flight of stairs leading to the playground. When I was little, the stairs appeared high and the flight of stairs long. After we moved away, I returned to the apartment complex about 10 years later, and I was shocked to see that the staircase appeared nothing like I had perceived it as a child. As a teenager, I saw that the steps were low and the staircase was short. Well, they could have remade the staircase, but let's assume they didn't, okay? So thinking about this made me wonder, how does a visual sense consciousness directly perceive shapes that are high and low, long and short? Yeah. Likewise, how can an ear sense consciousness directly perceive pleasant and unpleasant sounds, and a nose sense consciousness directly perceive fragrant and unfragrant odors? How about unpleasant odors? These subjective designations seem to require conceptual thought. Or is this possible for the Satantrikas, because they posit truly existent characteristics that appear directly to sense consciousnesses, and the system breaks down because how can truly existent phenomena appear differently to different consciousnesses when and have all of them be correct consciousnesses? Okay, so it's an interesting thing to think about. I think you could say from the perspective of the child, that was a reliable cognizer, and from the perspective of the teenager, it was also a reliable cognizer. But how we cognize things depends on the size of our body, you know, because, you know, that's how we discriminate short and tall and, you know, big and small and things like that. So, I mean, I don't think the Satantrikas could really debate that point and say, you know, well, really they're tall steps because the child saw them that way, or they're small steps because the adult saw them that way. You know, I think they would have to admit that, you know, you see things differently according to your size. But it does bring up the question, you know, how can two people, if things are truly existent, have two different experiences of them if there's no other, condition to make that happen? I mean, in the case of your size being a child and a teenager, that would be good. But when you talk about durian, the smell of durian, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, you know, I mean, it's two people's nose, you know, olfactory consciousness, and one goes, bleh, the other says, you know. So if they had true existence, it's difficult, you know, to say that. So I'm not quite sure. Anyone want to be a Satantrika and hazard a reply about how they would say that without being partial for or against durians? Yeah. It would be hard, wouldn't it? Yeah. But it does raise the question of, you know, how do you perceive big and small? And how do you perceive, you know, pleasant and unpleasant odors? Yeah? How can, you know, the sense really perceive that and be valid if two people cognize very different things. Okay. Then, yeah, you have an idea?
It reminds me of the feeling aggregate. And so the experience to the person who, you know, thinks something is unpleasant, it really is unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's kind of like their aggregate.
Yeah. I mean, we usually say that a lot of the feeling aggregate is due to previous karma. Yeah. But if you assert inherent existence, it does make that difficult. Yeah.
There's many different objects, you know, like the unpleasant durian that you experience really exists. And the pleasant durian that I experience really exists because we experience it that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe.
Very true. And that's why we quarrel. Yeah. Okay. So then she goes on and she says, I wonder then if this is how one might get into the mind-only view, you know, because you come across this problem with the Satvantrikas. So as a way to solve that problem, then, oh, you know, you see how the Chittamatra school makes sense, okay, that the high and long staircase truly exists for the child's perception, and the low and short staircase truly exists for the teenager's perceptions. Both perceptions are reliable. The external object with its truly existent characteristics must be produced by a latency at the same instant as the consciousness. Okay, so you have, according to Chittamatra, yeah, the short steps, the short low steps would... that the cause of those is not a prior moment of metal or whatever the steel, the shape, the steps are made out of, but a latency on the consciousness. And that latency produces both the sense object you're apprehending and the consciousness apprehending it. Yeah. So in that way, you know, you could see a little bit how people would go from Satvantrika to Chittamatra to answer some of those questions that came up in Satvantrika. Okay. Okay. So the Chittamatra say that the, let's say the smell of the durian is awful and truly existent awful. I have the mic because I have the mic. If you have the mic, the durian is truly existent, fragrant, and okay. So they assert that the durian and the smell of the durian would be truly existent because otherwise it wouldn't exist at all. Yeah, and yet, in spite of asserting things, you know, that have their own nature and are what they are, they still arise due to a latency on the consciousness, which does allow for certain subjectivity. Yeah, because latencies are created by people and people do different actions, and so you're going to have different latencies and different kind of perceptions. Okay. So, you know, for the Chittamatrans, yeah, they say that all these things are dependent, but they don't depend on being merely designated by term and concept. Okay, they exist dependent on the latencies. Okay, so then would the Prasangika view be that since high and low are mutually dependent, they must depend on conceptual consciousness and cannot appear to a direct perceiver? When we say that things depend on being conceived and designated, that doesn't mean that we have to be the one conceiving and designating them in that moment. Yeah, because if you said that, then we would never have any direct sense perceivers. Okay, but then if we never had any direct sense perceivers, then how could we have conceptual consciousnesses that conceived of things that we perceived with our senses, and then how could we label them? Okay, so when we say that things exist dependent on term and concept, it just means that things exist, that things exist in relationship to the mind. It doesn't mean my mind or your mind or a specific mind. Yeah, it doesn't mean that somebody has to be designated something right now. Okay, there's the story about, the Lama was in his room with a few students talking about, you know, how the pillars in the room existed by mere designation. And then the students left, and then the Lama was thinking, oh, if I leave too, then there's not going to be anybody designating the pillars, and the ceiling's going to collapse. Okay? So it doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean that things only exist because we're the ones designating them, and that we have to be designating them each particular moment for them to exist. And if we aren't designating them, then they totally become non-existent. That's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah. Because then that would mean, okay, as soon as I went out of the room and didn't perceive anything, then this room vanished. Okay, for me, the room became totally non-existent, and then it just popped back into existence the moment I walked into it. Yeah. So this is how, you know, a thing with babies, yeah, because babies, when mama leaves, they don't realize that mama can come back. They think she disappeared. And don't realize, oh, she's in another room, she's doing something else. Okay, so they get quite frightened in that way because of their lack of understanding. Yeah, so it seems like, due to the force maybe of habituation, we know that when somebody walks out of the room that they don't disappear completely. And we know when we walk out of the room that the room and the people in it don't just disappear. Otherwise, that would be a great way to get rid of your enemies, wouldn't it? You just walk out of the room and then they vanish completely. Yeah. Oh, which reminds me. Okay, here's a little detour here. Okay, so what kind of perception is this when you say that to buy cereal, you must have a voter ID card? Wrong consciousness. Okay, so then she continued. Separately, I found this information below about observed object conditions in your low-rig notes the Venerable Donya and I typed up years ago. Okay. Of course, I forgot that, you know, I was the one who took the notes and that I understood that, or at least believed it at one point, and so said the opposite because I didn't remember that. She has asthma. Okay, so the observed object condition is posited only for mental direct perceivers and for sense direct perceivers. It's not for yogic direct perceivers, self-knowers, or conceptual consciousnesses. Okay? So there's a difference between the observed object condition and the object of a consciousness. Okay, they aren't necessarily the same. Yeah, because you, the only consciousnesses that have observed object conditions are going to be sense and mental direct perceivers, because the observed object condition is something that sparks that consciousness and that casts an aspect on the consciousness. So for conceptual minds, that doesn't happen. And for yogic direct perceivers and self-knowers, it also doesn't happen. Now, we haven't talked very much about self-knowers. There are something that's asserted in some of the Buddhist schools, like the Sautantrikas. And they're kind of a funny idea, but you can see how somebody would assert them. And it's a knower that is not dual with, it's a knower that is together with another consciousness, and they're not two different knowers, but they aren't one either. They're non-dual. So the I consciousness perceives yellow, and the self-knower that's with that I consciousness perceives the mind perceiving yellow, and so knows that the mind that the I consciousness perceived yellow. Okay, so I don't really want to go into the ideas of self-knowers very much. That's, you know, we could do that when we get into, you know, lower again, more detail. But it's something that this school asserts and the Prasangikas refute. Okay, so three conditions needed for a sense-direct perceiver apprehending form. Okay, observed objective object condition of a sense-direct perceiver apprehending form is that which principally and directly produces a sense-direct perceiver apprehending form as having the aspect of that form. Yeah, isn't that clear? Okay, so it's, you know, if you're looking, it's the white color of the thermos is the observed object condition for our sense, our visual consciousness is perceiving white. Okay? Now, according to Sautantrika, it's the observed object condition because a sense-direct perceiver apprehending form is produced through the force of a form casting its aspect to it. Okay, so we have, remember this thing of casting its aspect on the consciousness. That is, the form appears to it. So that makes something, you know, there's an external object that casts its aspect on the sense consciousness or on the mental consciousness, meaning that it appears to that. Okay? So a form is also the observed object condition for a mental direct perceiver apprehending form produced after a sense direct perceiver apprehending form. So remember that after you have a series of moments of your visual consciousness apprehending yellow, then there's a very brief moment of a mental consciousness apprehending yellow. You weren't the one who jumped down, but you're too small. To be an actual observed objective condition, it must, one, appear to the mind, and two, that mind must be produced in dependence on it. Okay. So when you then think of a yogic direct perceiver realizing selflessness, according to this school, selflessness does not appear to that directly to that mind. It is what appears directly to that mind is the aggregates. And then selflessness is known implicitly. So regarding a yogic direct perceiver realizing selflessness, there's no observed object condition because, according to Sautantrika, selflessness does not appear to it because selflessness is a non-affirming negation and is permanent, and only impermanent phenomena are appearing objects of direct perceivers. Okay, So a yogic, that's according to this school. You know, according to Prasangika, permanent phenomena can appear directly to yogic direct perceivers, but not this school. A yogic direct perceiver realizing selflessness is produced depending on the meditative stabilization of serenity and insight, but that does not appear to it. So what are the empowering causes of the yogic direct perceiver knowing selflessness? Okay, the concentration that is a union of serenity and insight. Okay, but there's no objective condition to it, for that consciousness. So regarding a yogic direct perceiver realizing impermanence, there's also no observed object condition, because here the object, not the observed object condition, but the object impermanence does not cast its aspect to that cognizer. It's produced through the force of meditation. Okay. And my guess is, how do you realize subtle impermanence directly? Because what is appearing to that yogic direct perceiver is some form or, you know, some impermanent phenomena. And you can see that impermanent phenomena change. And so you know the impermanence implicitly. Yeah. That's my guess how it's done. So impermanence is the observed object, the migyal, or just the object, but not the observed object condition. Okay, so it's the object, that's what you're perceiving, but it's not an observed object condition. Yeah, why not? The object is not casting its aspect on that consciousness. Okay, we're going to skip about the self-knowers. And then let's go on to conception. So there's no observed object condition for a conceptual consciousness, because what appears to it is a conceptual appearance, which is permanent. Okay, so again, there's no object casting its aspect on that consciousness. Conception is produced not by the force of an external object, but of the cognizer which induces it. In other words, a prior sense direct perceiver, memory, and so forth. Okay, so why do we have a conceptual consciousness? Not because there's an external object, you know, that we directly see that casts its aspect on the conceptual consciousness, but because we had a prior sense direct perceiver, and now we're remembering, you know, what that sense direct perceiver saw. Okay? So an observed object condition is posited only for sense direct perceivers and mental direct perceivers. Okay, that's if you remember that, then you know the essence. And then if asked why, it's because for those kind of direct perceivers, the object casts an aspect, you know, on the consciousness. Okay, so whatever is color or shape isn't necessarily the object apprehended by an eye consciousness. For example, the blue, which is the observed object condition for a mental direct perceiver apprehending blue, that blue exists for the smallest moment and can't be apprehended by an eye consciousness. Okay. So usually we say color and shape are the objects apprehended by a visual consciousness, but not always, because if you have a brief moment of that, that can be apprehended by the mental direct perceiver. But the sense consciousnesses can't apprehend something so quickly. But the mental one knows it It's an inattentive awareness too, for the mental one. Okay, and then one more thing that she wrote up. For the Chittamatras, the predispositions which exist with the immediately preceding condition of that consciousness and which cause it to be generated as having not it, but the next moment of consciousness to be generated as having the aspect of blue, are the observed object condition for sense-direct perceivers and mental-direct perceivers. Okay, yeah, so basically the latencies on the mind of the immediately preceding consciousness are the observed object condition, okay, for the sense-direct perceivers in the next moment, because those latencies produce both the subject and the consciousness. Okay. The form which is apprehended by that sense-direct perceiver or mental-direct perceiver is called the appearing object condition, but it's not an actual observed object condition because it's one substantial entity with that consciousness and thus exists simultaneous with it. Okay, so that's why, according to Chittamatras, whatever we're perceiving with our eye consciousnesses, that object is not an observed object condition of the eye consciousness because it occurs simultaneous with that eye consciousness and causes always have to occur before the result. Okay. So what do you posit then as the observed object condition for Chittamatras? The latency on the mind stream. Got it?
Makes the most sense.
Yeah, you can see how people, you know, got to Chittamatra. Yeah. But then, you know, sometimes then you go and you think some more about Chittamatra and you get questions and then it doesn't make sense. Yeah. But, you know, certainly it answers questions that the Satantrikas couldn't handle. So we're on the heading, the subheading, a range of consciousnesses in relation to what they perceive, right? Okay. So now, with some acquaintance with the Buddhist descriptions of conceptual consciousnesses and direct perceivers, it is easier to understand the range of consciousnesses in relation to what they perceive. This is a graded list of seven consciousnesses that are ordered from the least reliable, which does not engage its object at all, to the most reliable, which engages its object exactly as it is. Now, I must say, his list of seven, this is the only time I've ever seen his list of seven, okay? In all the Lohrig books, what he posits as the third and fourth one are different. Yeah, third and fourth. Yeah, anyway, there's two of them in there that all the other lists don't have that he put in here, and as a result, he left two out. So we'll read through his list. He doesn't say what the source of it is, but you can see how it makes sense for what he's trying to explain. Laying it out this way makes sense, okay? But it's not the usual list. Though it is a graded range of consciousnesses, do not think that it is necessary to move through the list in order. Clearly, depending on your consciousness and your object, you can jump in anywhere on the list. For instance, just look at a patch of color nearby, and in all likelihood, you have a direct perception of that color. As you would imagine, direct perception is the best on the list. Okay. Also, bear in mind that this is not a comprehensive list of all consciousnesses. There are types left over that are not included here, such as an awareness to which the object appears but is not ascertained. For example, this is like when you are walking along, tapping on your magic box. Your phone is a magic box? Okay. Tapping on your magic box, and you do not see the blossoms of spring all around you or the cars coming at you at 60 miles an hour. The objects appear, but they do not cause you to ascertain them until you hit the car. Okay, an awareness to which the object appears but is not ascertained is not always due to the lack of vivid attention, but may be a natural disability of the consciousness. For instance, whereas a direct perceiver is always a consciousness to which a specifically characterized phenomena appears together with all of its uncommon characteristics, such a direct perceiver does not necessarily ascertain those appearing characteristics. So what it's saying is that what appears to a sense consciousness is not necessarily the appearing object of that sense consciousness. Right? So don't get confused, because you would think that the appearing object is what appears to the consciousness. It's not. What appears to consciousness may be the appearing object, but it may not be. Okay. In the case of a directly perceiving eye consciousness apprehending blue, it is a non-mistaken knower correctly ascertaining the color that appears to it. However, it does not ascertain the subtle impermanence of that specifically characterized phenomenon, even though that naturally appears along with it as a characteristic of the color. Okay, so to what consciousness does the impermanence of that color appear to? A yogic direct perceiver. Okay, thus, with respect to its appearing object, blue, that visual consciousness, is a direct perceiver. However, with respect to the subtle impermanence of the blue, it is an awareness to which an object appears but is not ascertained.
Subtle impermanence only appears to a yogic direct perceiver. Why are we...
No, it doesn't only appear. It's only cognized by a yogic.
But it does appear to... Okay, that's what he's
saying. It appears to the sense consciousness, okay. But it is one of those consciousnesses where it appears but is not ascertained with respect to the subtle impermanence. Okay. Okay. So it's interesting, something can appear to the object, to the consciousness. The fact that we don't see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Okay. Because the kind of consciousness that cognizes that could be a different kind of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. How do you know that it's appearing to the visual consciousness and we're not apprehending if nobody apprehends it?
That you have to ask Dharmakirti.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Dharmakirti said so. You can think, well, what are the advantages of saying that? And what would be the disadvantages of not saying that?
Your only other option is that your table there is permanent. So you have to figure it out by logic that there's no other choice for it to be.
Right. So the impermanence of the table or the yellow or whatever it is would be a slightly obscure phenomena. But it still appears to the visual consciousness that is unable to apprehend it. Now, why do we say it appears to that visual consciousness? And what proof do we have that it appears to that visual consciousness?
I understand your question, but to me it still goes back to logic because it would have to. Because what are your
logic is how we know that right. subtle impermanence. But the question is, how can you prove that that subtle impermanence appears to the visual consciousness? Why can't you just say the subtle impermanence only appears to a yogic direct perceiver? Why can't you say that and just leave out the visual consciousness altogether?
What is your visual consciousness seeing then? What is your visual consciousness seeing then?
Your visual consciousness is seeing the color, but it's not seeing the impermanence of the color. The impermanence of the color appears to the visual consciousness, but the visual consciousness does not apprehend it or ascertain it. It's an inattentive perception with respect to the subtle impermanence.
Wouldn't that be saying that something other than color and shape is appearing to a visual consciousness?
Yeah, that's exactly what it's saying.
I thought only color and shape appear to a visual consciousness.
No,
only
color and shape and all of its characteristics appear. Okay, so impermanence is one of those characteristics. It appears, but it is not ascertained.
So if I watch an ice cube melt, and it takes 5 minutes to watch it to yeah. melt, and I watch it the whole time, at least enough to see that it's melted some?
Yeah, that's not an apprehension of some.
No, it's not an apprehension of it, but no. If I've apprehended the gross impermanence by watching that, and I was watching it the whole time, then I know that my eye consciousness must have been perceiving those moments. So even though it's not apprehending it, it must have been perceiving the subtle impermanence.
No.
Because it's seeing it every moment, and the moments are it's changing
yeah,
every
no,
moment.
But it's not seeing that momentary change. It's only seeing the gross change. Yeah. You may be watching it, but you're not perceiving every subtle change.
I'm not talking about what I'm perceiving. I'm talking about what's actually appearing.
Yeah.
That's how we might prove that it's appearing, is that if it's appearing in my eyes the whole time and it's subtly changing, then that must be what's appearing.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
And through the gross impermanence, we could maybe prove that.
Okay.
If it's appearing the whole time.
If it's appearing the whole time, but
then,
not being
then
ascertained.
The subtle impermanence must be appearing, even yeah. if it's not being ascertained.
Yeah, yeah, I get what you're saying.
So that would make it a slightly obscured phenomenon.
Yeah, and that's why you would
reason it out as Venerable
why you need inference to know it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So maybe that's the reason why. Yeah. It's appearing, but you don't know it. Okay. Anyway. Yeah. Look it up. See what you can find. Okay. Okay, however, it does not ascertain the subtle impermanence of that specifically characterized phenomena, even though that naturally appears along with it as a characteristic of the color. Thus, with respect to the appearing object, blue, it is a direct perceiver. However, with respect to the subtle impermanence of blue, it is an awareness to which an object appears but is not ascertained. Such an eye consciousness is a non-mistaken, non-conceptual knower of blue. But because subtle impermanence is an object of engagement for a mental consciousness only, the eye does not cognize all that appears to it. Thus, the content of a direct perception is influenced by the perceiving consciousness. In other words, the consciousness has to be able to apprehend that. Okay, so this list of consciousnesses focuses on the issue of how we know what we know and suggests how to distinguish between what we know and what we merely believe. Something quite interesting. Oh, yeah. No wonder. Okay. Some consciousnesses know their objects clearly and accurately. Others are mere beliefs, whether that which is perceived is real or not. Others are outright wrong. Think of this as a scale of 7 consciousnesses that a person may have in relation to some particular object or belief. Here they are listed in order from the least reliable to the most reliable. Okay? So it's interesting to go through things that we think we know and see which kind of cognizer knows them. Okay. So I know that person's mad at me. Yeah, I could tell by the expression on their face. So what consciousness is it that knows that person's mad at us? Well, maybe you can't say it's wrong. Maybe the person is wrong. Is that mad at us? It's a conceptual consciousness. We don't know if it's right or wrong. Yeah, but based on the reason of somebody's facial expression, we're using that to make a syllogism. That syllogism is incorrect. Yeah, there's no privation with the syllogism. Okay.
It's the I know that's the wrong consciousness.
Huh?
It's the I know that's the wrong consciousness.
Yeah, well, does the I even know
so
somebody?
Say, I know someone is mad at me.
Yeah.
The wrong consciousness is that I know anything about that. Right?
Wait a minute, we're talking, what type of consciousness is it?
Right. But I know that person is mad at me, so it's a conceptual consciousness that's...
Yes.
But to even say, I know, is wrong.
Yeah. Because we're making a syllogism, and it's an incorrect syllogism, so we don't know. But the point here is, we think we know.
Yes.
Okay. And he comes back to this at the end of the chapter, and he says, you know, we're all quite willing to admit that there's a lot of things that we don't know, that we're ignorant about, that we need to learn. But we're not always ready to admit that what we believe is incorrect. So when we form a belief, somebody is mad at me, yeah, then that is much more difficult to deal with than just, I'm ignorant about the topic. That's the point, you know. And if we say, I'm ignorant, I don't know, then we're quite open to learning. But it's when we have beliefs, and of course, we always believe our beliefs are true. Otherwise, we wouldn't have them. Yeah, because we wouldn't deliberately believe something is wrong, but we do believe a lot of wrong things. Okay, so the first one here is a wrong consciousness. Okay, so a knower that is mistaken with regard to its object of engagement. Okay, so another thing, you know, that's interesting is we have, you know, in the government, we have certain Pentagon people saying that they're in 16 sites, the North Korea is enlarging its nuclear arsenal. You know, they're still doing nuclear stuff. And you have the president who says we have no more danger of any nuclear problem with North Korea. Okay? So we have two different statements. And as the public, we, you know, trying to figure out which statement, you know, is a correct statement. Yeah. And we have to trust others because we don't know how to fly over North Korea and see whether they're enlarging their nuclear arsenal or not. Yeah, we can't do it. We have to rely on authoritative testimony, and we're getting different authoritative testimony from different supposed authorities.
It's cool for the one who doesn't know how to buy cereal.
Or maybe the let's go for the one who knows how to buy cereal.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it? You know, when you see, and this is happening so much now, that you get totally conflicting reports about what is happening. Yeah. What?
Voter fraud in Florida.
Yeah. Is it an existent phenomena or is it a non-existent? Yeah. And we have to rely on authoritative testimony. And we get, you know, not just two opinions, but many opinions about what's going on with the voting system in Florida.
This is my opinion. This is a well-known device in governments of different nations.
Mm-hmm.
It happened in Germany, it happened in Russia, and now it's happening here. It's happened across Europe. This is a device where you inject doubt, just as he said in this chapter, and then people who have their perceptions of things, it weakens it. I think that Dan Perdue has it right on that first thing when I don't think we get it at all about direct perceivers. And I think his point here, he says, thus the content of direct perception is influenced by the perceiving consciousness. I think that things are so real for what we see, mm-hmm. for example, that we don't doubt it until somebody then, you know, we don't have it, but we don't have it solidly because it's not incontrovertible, right? Because a lot of things that we see are like sense consciousness, but they're not really direct perceivers, I think.
Well, no, but if it's a direct perceiver and a reliable one, then it's incontrovertible. We may think things are reliable direct perceivers when they aren't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but if it is a reliable a direct reliable perceiver, it's incontrovertible.
Yeah, but then if you're having to rely on the testimony of people who figure those things out,
okay, then that's
inject doubt into that.
Right, but that is not a sense direct perceiver of that information. That's an inference by power of authoritative testimony.
For the one who didn't do the research.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, but so much of what we know, we can't verify ourselves, because we have to believe other people.
We have partial information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like,
but even the partial information, we can't verify, because if somebody starts giving me information about how a drug works, because this molecule binds to that molecule, which does the other thing, I may hear the thing and have a direct, reliable cognizer of the words, but I'm not educated in that field. So even though they may be telling me the truth, because I'm not educated in that field, I can't understand it. And I haven't gone to the lab and verified for myself what all those molecules were doing and binding to. So I'm taking that person's word for it. And they may be mistaken, but they may not even know that they're mistaken.
I think this is my point, and you're saying it better than I can. Because if you use the example of climate change, mm-hmm. where you have 99% of the scientists saying it's real, but you only need 1% of people to inject doubt that makes it such a problem.
Yeah.
It's exact. Good example for this, and it's a strategy.
Yeah, yeah, and he does talk about this, you know, of
Yeah, of lawyers. Did you read the chapter? Yeah. So that's very clever, and that's really what is happening a lot, I think, nowadays, is people will believe the authoritative testimony of somebody, and then, which may be correct or may not be correct, but then somebody else comes in and says, well, who's that guy? They don't know anything. You know, and then you start to doubt the authoritative testimony, and you don't know what to believe, and then somebody can tell you what to believe. And then especially if a lot of other people say, oh, yes, that's true, then even though you may have a doubt inclined towards the right thing, you don't want to be different from the group, so you accept what the group says.
Renowned in the world.
Yeah. But renowned in the world doesn't mean it exists. Okay. So here, that's why studying this is really important, because it makes us ask ourselves, how do I know something incontrovertibly? And what are areas where I need to be careful, because I think I know something, but because I don't really know what is a reliable cognizer, I don't really know if I know it. It's scary when you think about it. Yeah, how easily people can be Oh, I have the hiccups again. How easily people can be manipulated. Yeah. Well, they. Oh, but I'll do it again, I'm sure. Okay. So, a wrong consciousness definition. A knower that is mistaken with regard to its object of engagement. Okay, so divisions. There are two types of wrong consciousnesses. Conceptual wrong consciousnesses, for example, a thought consciousness apprehending the horns of a rabbit or the belief that the earth is flat.
It seems to me that although a person may rely on, scriptural testimony,
Authoritative testimony.
Still, that doesn't mean that we have an inference. And yeah. So that's, I think, why that mind can be swayed by doubt, is because we have a quick assumption.
Yeah. They call it inference by authoritative testimony, but I don't think it's incontrovertible inference.
No. Well, how could it be? It can only be inference if you have worked with it enough to actually have come to a clear appearance of your object. And I think we can hear a authoritative testimony, but that doesn't mean we have an inference and
right.
an incontrovertible consciousness.
So yeah.
I think this is where why people are so swayed, even though they might have heard some really good testimony of someone who knows what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there's this doubt created because of all this alternative
fact. Yeah, because you're believing something that you can't verify yourself, even though there are conditions for discerning something as a reliable scripture, you know, still it's not whole proof. So I'm with you on that one, but some people have other ideas. Anyway, this jumps around. Okay, conceptual wrong consciousness. Yeah, we did that. Then a non-conceptual wrong consciousness, like a sense consciousness apprehending two moons where there is only one. But where there are two moons, it's okay to apprehend two. And when you're looking at Jupiter, how many?
Yeah.
Huh? Right, exactly. So you can apprehend them. Okay, or an icon. Okay, or another non-conceptual wrong consciousness is an eye consciousness seeing white snow as blue. Yeah, but I wonder if it's not blue. Yeah? Because, you know, if the light, I mean, the color of something, doesn't the color depend on the way the light hits it?
What color light it's reflecting. What color light it's absorbing.
Yeah.
In this book where Dan and the producer said that they could even take a picture of it and it looked blue.
And it looks blue.
So that's where I think it's like, we haven't like looked at the complexity of it. It's like, from that perspective, the conditions of the environment are such that it appears blue.
Blue,
and
yeah.
From another perspective, when you're close up to it, it would appear white because the conditions are different. Once
yeah.
you could take a picture of it, that helps to, you know, it's like, what's like a rainbow, you know? You're going to say you don't see a rainbow? Well, you have to be in a certain place to see a rainbow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, so it's difficult because if you say, you know, only the light that shines this way that makes it look white, that is a, you know, shows it in a valid way. But all the other ways that light shines it are invalid. Why, you know?
Like now that we have these new light bulbs.
No, seriously. Right, yeah.
Now that we have, what are the ones, not the LEDs, but the CFLs, I think it was. Mm-hmm. They all have those color things. And there's certain ones that you can, they show you this in the store. You can look at one object and you can put on these different lights and it changes the color of it completely.
Yeah.
Which one is valid?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's where, you know, you can't be too rigid regarding this. If you're too rigid, you keep getting stuck. Yeah. So wrong consciousnesses are 3P with consciousnesses, and with consciousnesses mistaken with regard to their appearing objects. They are 4P with sense consciousnesses, mental consciousness, conceptual consciousnesses, and non-conceptual consciousness. So let's go over, we won't go through all of those, okay? But, okay, so there's the wrong consciousnesses, compare wrong consciousnesses with consciousnesses mistaken with regard to their appearing object. Okay, so is there something that's both a wrong consciousness and a consciousness mistaken with regard to its appearing object?
I perceiving one moon as two. A visual consciousness perceiving one moon as two.
Yeah, okay. So it's a wrong consciousness, and it's also consciousness mistaken with regard to its appearing object. Is there something that's a wrong consciousness that is not mistaken with regard to its appearing object?
No.
Okay. Is there something that is a consciousness mistaken with regard to its appearing object that is not a wrong consciousness?
A thought thinking of one moon.
Yeah. Okay. And is there something that is neither? The moon, yeah. Uh-huh.
So for the wrong consciousness that is not mistaken, we said there's nothing, but I did this comparison.
Not mistaken with respect to what?
To its object.
Which object?
To its appearing object.
So
you, we're asking if there's a wrong consciousness that is not mistaken with regard to its appearing object.
Uh-huh.
So I thought of the example of an eye consciousness that perceives one person who's a twin, but they think it's the other twin. So they perceive that person correctly, but they understand them wrongly.
Yeah, but that's a conceptual consciousness.
But didn't we say the eye consciousness knows people? According to
yeah, but I think yeah,
I mean,
that's
system,
what's
I'm
difficult.
Not
you know,
it's, you know, right or wrong. But
yeah,
I thought that could be an example.
Well, but then it would be still mistaken regarding to its appearing object because it's the other twin, not your twin.
But they see the person correctly.
Yeah.
They see the form, the color, the shape, but they, you know, understand wrongly the engaged object and
so yeah.
on. But,
I think that's where it you can't just say that that's where this thing of saying that the I consciousness sees the person gets kind of weird. Don't you think? Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they hold, right? The Sautrantikas? They say this.
Yeah, that's what they hold.
So then that would, it should be 4P, I would think.
Yeah, because it's the wrong consciousness because they identify the wrong person. Is it wrong with regard to its appearing object? Well, yeah, because it's the other twin that's appearing, not the twin you think it is.
Well, they're seeing the person, but they're identifying them incorrectly. They see the body.
Yeah, but you could also say they're seeing one person as the appearing object. Okay, and what am I going to say? How do I do it? Somebody help me out. Yeah, the other is the engaged object, but. You may be perceiving that person. You're perceiving a person, but you're not perceiving the person you think you're perceiving. Okay, so it would still be incorrect regarding the appearing object because the person you think is the appearing object isn't. It's the twin. There's different ways to use the language, yeah, to describe it. So,
or more clever example of neither would be direct reliable cognizer.
Right. Yeah. An inference or something like that. Okay. A wrong consciousness is mistaken with regard to both its appearing object and its object of engagement. Okay, so this is good to remember because sometimes I read one person who was saying the appearing object is white snow and the engaged object is blue snow. But if it's mistaken with regard to both its appearing object and its object of engagement, then you can't say the appearing object is white snow. Yeah, the appearing object is blue snow. You know, so there's the point is that this consciousness is erroneous with respect to its appearing object and its engaged object. But people assert what that appearing object is. They may assert it differently.
And then there's a place in mind in Tibetan Buddhism where they talk about this and we're talking about what it is to be mistaken, which you would probably say erroneous, but they use the word mistaken for that. And there's these four kinds of mistake that we make, and this one of the color of the snow is an error in the base. It's interesting that they have error in the object, error in the base. Error in the object is like when you think you're moving and you aren't, you know, when the color moves. But this one is the example of error in the base, which is interesting. Like, what's the difference?
I would think the base. Usually, the base is the object.
Well, they have four, and that's the first two. I have to look up.
Do you remember where it is in mind in Tibetan Buddhism?
I typed it out, so I have it here. It's on. I don't know what page, but here's what it says. Let's see. The four causes of error are the cause of error existing in the object, the cause of error existing in the base, the cause of error existing in the abode, and the cause of error existing in the immediately preceding condition. So those are the four. I didn't put down the page it's on.
Hmm. Does the base mean the sense power?
They don't explain it. Basis.
Basis.
Yeah. And so.
They didn't explain
it. It seems like that's more on the side of. Somehow it puts is the appearing object, it's on the subject side. Right? We're talking about the consciousness. You know what I mean? Like, I think we always think of it as being on the object side, but is the appearing object is the appearing object to the consciousness.
Yeah.
So in a sense, I'm putting that on the subject side, the consciousness side, rather than the thing out there. And that's why I would maybe call it a basis. It's the basis of your...
Yeah, we have to find out what it means. We don't know what they mean by basis. Yeah.
It doesn't say anymore.
Yeah, we have to find that out. You know, it might mean the sense power, but keep reading, see if you can find out what that is. It might be in my notes and I from years ago and I can't remember it.
Be talking about when we're talking about these objects, like an appearing object, are we talking about the thing out there or are we talking about what's happening in the consciousness?
That's what's unclear. Yeah. And that's why some people might say that it's blue snow appearing, that's the appearing object, and other people might say it's white snow, that's the appearing object. But the point is that consciousness is erroneous with respect to its appearing object and its engaged object. Yeah, because if it's blue snow, definitely blue snow, I mean, according to their viewpoint, you know, then blue snow isn't the actual object. And if it's white snow, then it's erroneous because the white snow is appearing blue. Okay, so that's the point of it. And different people verbalize it in different ways. I think even we have to see how he did in this book. I have some memory he might have done it in the other way in a previous chapter. Anyway, a wrong consciousness is mistaken with regard to both its appearing object and its object of engagement, whether it is a sense consciousness or a mental consciousness, and whether it is a conceptual consciousness or a non-conceptual consciousness. Both what appears to it and what it perceives do not accord with the fact. Such a consciousness is wrong, incorrect, inaccurate, and not factually concordant. And it's inherently existent fake news, for it does not get at its object of engagement at all. Yeah. So depending upon your perspective, yeah, the fake news could be CNN or it could be Fox News. Everybody agrees that there's fake news, but what is the source of the fake news? People cannot agree. Wrong consciousnesses of all types are the least reliable of all consciousnesses. Well said, because if we believe in them, then we're really getting ourselves in trouble. Okay. An uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is not factual. Okay. So this is doubt and clawing towards the wrong conclusion. So the next three on the list of seven consciousnesses in relation to the objects they perceive are three different kinds of uncertain consciousnesses or doubts. I'm not drunk. I just have the hiccups again. These consciousnesses are mere suspicions tending to believe something, but are entirely uncertain about it. All three of these are ahead of a wrong consciousness, which is decisive and settled in its wrong belief or perception. An uncertain consciousness is compared to a double-headed needle. That is, a needle shaped like the letter Y. You cannot sew with a double-headed needle. Double-headed needle. No, I usually say double-pointed. A needle doesn't have a head. Yeah, you can tell he never sewed. Okay. You cannot sew with a double-pointed needle, as it will not pass through the fabric. In the same way, a consciousness that is a mere uncertain suspicion is stuck like the needle, We all know that feeling of getting stuck in uncertainty so that we cannot pierce through to see how things are. It's like having too many variables in a formula. You just can't sort it out. A mere uncertain consciousness always reflects some measure of confusion or at least a failure to settle on a right belief or wrong. So this is like trying to get the septic system done. There's too many variables, so you don't have, you know, a reliable consciousness that can say when the septic system's going to be done, you know? So it's definitely a doubting one. Which one of the three doubts? We don't even know, okay? Because we don't know what it's going to turn out to be. According to Lati Rinpoche, doubting consciousnesses are among the worst types of mind. If one is traveling along a road, constantly wondering, is this the right road or not? It is difficult to arrive at one's destination. Similarly, if one is on the path of liberation and constantly wonders, is this the path of liberation or not? Will this help or not? Can I attain liberation or not? It is difficult to make any progress in one's meditation. Okay, so we can really see, you know, very clearly the problem with the doubting mind, you know, and you know, to be able to ascertain when it's a genuine doubt, when it is curiosity, and when it is self-centered mind making us confused because it has nothing better to do. Yeah, and so, oh, you know, should I practice Tibetan Buddhism? Maybe I should practice Theravada, but I don't know. The Kabbalah sounds really good, and, you know, I can also do crystals, and maybe I can combine them all together and throw some Reiki in there too, and, you know, and then come out with this really wonderful path. But I'm not sure which one I should do. Should I include crystals, or should I include Reiki? You know, or maybe I shouldn't include any of them. Okay. And then you get really stuck. Okay. So, What?
Just go with the drugs.
So, okay, you're checking your palm. Yeah. Okay, so, but we can see, I mean, this is what gets a lot of people stuck in their Dharma practice. You know, should I follow this teacher or should I follow that teacher? Should I do this meditation? Should I do that meditation? Yeah, do I believe this view of emptiness or do I believe that view of emptiness? You know, and so that kind of, you know, sometimes it can be, because we need more curiosity, we need more study, we need more contemplation to be able to discern something, and we haven't made the effort from our own side to really break through and get the clarity. And sometimes it's, you know, the self-centered mind that is just, you know, being like a child and saying, I don't want to believe, and you make me, and why should I believe you and not the other guy? Yeah. So, you know, you have to be sensitive in your own mind kind of when it's this self-centeredness that's creating a problem. And when it's a genuine doubt that you can remedy by study and contemplation. In a dispute, creating doubt effectively beguiles others and keeps them from knowledge. We see this all the time, and here's the part Venerable Tarpa was talking about. A friend of mine who was attending law school at the time said that they were taught three steps in regard to courtroom procedure. First, if at all possible, prove your case by what they call black letter law. This refers to the legal code, which is printed in black letters. This is the easiest, for if you just point out the relevant part of the law it is settled. It is hard to believe that many cases go to trial and get settled by black letter law. Then, my friend said, if you cannot prove your case by the written law, seek to prove it by precedent. This happens frequently. The lawyers will argue that this case before the court today is like that case that was before another court on another occasion, and that case was settled in such and such a way, and so the case before the court today should also be settled in that way. You can see this with the Supreme Court, and I mean, lots of courts decide things based on precedent. Not that it's necessarily a good way or an accurate way, but many people do it. Finally, my friend said, if you cannot prove your case by black letter law or by precedent, then muddy the waters. Just as you imagine, this means to stir up the sediment so that you cannot see through the water. Thus, the third step, if you have to do it, is to create doubt and uncertainty. This, too, happens all the time. Muddying the waters is often the last refuge of scoundrels. True, isn't it? You know? Get people confused. Make them doubt their own perception. Make them doubt the information they're getting. Yeah? Get everybody very, very confused. And then say that you are the one leader who will lead them out of the confusion. They can trust you, whereas they cannot trust anybody else. And this is what we have to be very careful of. So the definition of an uncertain consciousness in general is a knower that has qualms with regard to its own object. The divisions, there's three types of uncertain consciousnesses, and the next three on the list of seven consciousnesses are, so this one, number two, is the first on the list here, an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is not factual, like a two-pointed mind thinking sound is probably permanent. Okay, second one, which is number three in the list, an equivocating uncertain consciousness, wavering between believing something that is not factual and believing something that is factual. Like a hesitating consciousness, which wonders whether sound is permanent or impermanent. And then third is an uncertain consciousness leading towards believing something that is factual, like a two-pointed mind thinking sound is probably impermanent. Now the thing with these three kinds of uncertain knowledge, consciousness, these three kinds of doubt, we don't know which kind we have when we have it. We are only going to know afterwards when we've reached a reliable cognizer which kind of doubt we had. These three are listed in a graded series from the least reliable, tending to believe something that is not real, to the most reliable, tending to believe something that is real. And we may have, you know, a doubting consciousness inclined towards the wrong conclusion, and then at some point realize it's the wrong conclusion and throw that doubt out, and then generate another kind of doubt or maybe even a correct assumption. Uncertain consciousnesses in general, and each of the three types, are 3P with consciousnesses, consciousnesses mistaken with regard to their appearing objects, mental consciousnesses, and conceptual consciousnesses. They all are mutually exclusive with sense consciousnesses and non-conceptual consciousnesses. So the first of these three is an uncertain consciousness leaning towards believing something that is not factual. Here the belief is not decisive like a wrong consciousness, but in this type of uncertain belief, the person is tending to go the wrong way, to believe something that is not accurate. People with such a doubting consciousness think, probably such and such is the case, when actually it is not the case. Okay, so maybe next Tuesday in your, you know, your debating class, go through these comparisons of the different kinds of wrong consciousnesses and doubting consciousnesses with the different kinds of consciousness. Okay? That'll give you a better understanding.
So this goes back to earlier about, can we perceive subtle impermanence, or you know, can a sense consciousness? And so this person was asking whether a mental consciousness can, whether subtle impermanent appears to a mental consciousness but is not ascertained.
Yeah, that that mental consciousness, the one brief moment that occurs after a stream of sense consciousnesses, that it would still appear to that mental consciousness, but it would not be ascertained. Yeah, but subtle impermanence is ascertained by a yogic direct perceiver, which is a type of mental consciousness. Okay, but a special type, not the regular type.
For the doubts here, his titles are quite long. What was it that you were calling the middle one from the other?
Oh, doubt going either way.
Doubt wavering?
It's in the middle. It's saying, well, it could be this or it could be that, and it's not partial towards one or the other.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I understood the kind of the concept of it. I was just wondering if you had a much better title.
Than he has, doubt.
He's got a title of an un...
doubt that's equally divided, you know, something like that.
Thank you.
Yeah, uncertain consciousness is a lot of syllables. It's easier to say doubt, isn't it? I'll close. But lots to think about, you know, and really look at our different mental states and really see, you know, how, you know, when do we have a direct perceiver that's correct? When do we have a, you know, an inference? And when is it one or the other kind of thing that some things that may be better than wrong consciousnesses, but they aren't incontrovertible? You know, and I would say, unless you're a scientist who's done the experiment and come to a conclusion, most of our knowledge about science is assumption, you know? And it's hopefully correct assumption, but sometimes it winds up being not correct assumption.
When I was a kid, my great-grandparents, I lived with them for quite a while, and my grandfather's world book from the 20s was the book I studied as a child. So a lot of my scientific understanding is based on that from the 1920s. It's totally wrong.
Yeah.
But I still realize that that's kind of where I come from.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And when Teresa Birch was here, she was talking about how she works with medical students about challenging the idea of medical intuition. Because you've seen certain cases so many times, you immediately make a certain assumption that it's going to be a certain outcome or this is the diagnosis. But that's not always the case.
Right. But sometimes you ignore those intuitions and you could have used them to benefit somebody. Yeah. So it depends on who's having the intuition. Is it somebody who's brand new or somebody who has a lot of experience who basically is making some sort of inference based on their previous experience. Yeah, which may be right or wrong, but that's very different than somebody who just, well, I feel like it's this. And, you know, that person has no experience in seeing such cases at all.